I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. The current state of the world's oceans is given a critical, timely, and important examination in a new book, Seasick, The Global Ocean in Crisis. Everything about the ocean is being altered, the species within them, the ocean's temperature, acidity, volume, and circulation, among other aspects. The book's author, Alana Mitchell, joins me now, a former environmental reporter for the Globe and Mail. She traveled the world's oceans to see firsthand what's happening. It's an authoritative account. Tim Flannery writes that it is a riveting book of revelations. It is published by McClelland and Stewart and retails for $32.99. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Alana Mitchell. Good morning, Ms. Mitchell.
Good morning.
What compelled you to write this book?
Oh, you know, I could say it was sheer idiocy. I needed to understand how the ocean worked. I needed to, it's just, I come from a background of scientists, and I'm a journalist, but the impulse to understand is quite strong, and I think I just I fastened on, you know, how the planet worked, and just had to keep going until I had it to some degree figured out.
Your dad's a biologist?
My dad's a biologist. Yeah, he was one of the early ecologists in the prairies, and you know, my childhood was sort of fed by these stories of how his quests of how the planet worked, how that part of the planet was working. It was just something we had at the dinner table, you know.
Now, we haven't been spending any time thinking about the world's oceans. Why do you think we haven't?
We are, we're terrestrial. We just think that what we see around us is the whole planet. So, or maybe we think about things like the Amazon as being the real planet, but because we live in air, we don't think about things that live in water as being equally or more as important as we are, or more important.
But we see this year after year. I mean, in America, the space program seems to be funded more,
right,
and more. What is it about, I guess, the oceans that frustrates you as a journalist, as someone who's written this book?
Well, I think that we think of them as something quite abstract, when in fact they're not abstract at all. They hold the switch of life on the planet. Life originated in the ocean, and when the ocean changes too quickly, then life on the planet dies. That's been shown to happen in earlier mass extinctions that have occurred on the planet. So it seems to me that it's the origin, but also the future of life on the planet, and that we ignore it at our peril. But you're right, we do ignore it, and I don't know. I guess we just haven't had a sense of where we fit into this great dance of life on the planet, and now we're getting a bit of a sense of it.
So when you talk about the switch of life, if that's flicked off,
right,
and it's happened, I think, what, 5 times previously?
Yes.
What that leads to extinction, what exactly happens?
Well,
What has happened? Yeah.
Let's talk about the Permian extinction, and that happened 250 million years ago. And something like 95% of all the species on the planet died during that time. And the characteristics of that were, as we've been able to, you know, piece together from, you know, from this time, from this vantage point, the characteristics of that were a warmer ocean, global ocean, a more acidic global ocean, and great swaths of ocean that had no oxygen, no dissolved oxygen in them. So what happened was that 95% of species died out. There were 5% that held on somehow. They were able to adapt, or the changes didn't affect them in as catastrophic ways. The genetic pool shrank down to this little, this little refugia of genetic material. And they were able, over millions and millions of years, to evolve into other life forms that, you know, survived until the next cataclysmic mass extinction happened. So every time this happens, it's happened 5 times before in the history of the planet. The last time was when the dinosaurs died out. But every time it happens, life eventually springs up again, and it usually becomes more complex forms of life.
So these three things, a warmer ocean, an acidic ocean, and no oxygen.
Yep.
Are we close to those things now?
We have changed the pH of the global ocean by 0.15 of a unit, meaning it's dramatically more acidic than it was before we started burning fossil fuels. And the mechanism there is that as carbon dioxide goes up into the atmosphere, it gets a third of it gets absorbed into the ocean, where it chemically transforms into carbonic acid. So it's making the global ocean more acidic. So that's a CO2 issue. And that's measurable. We've done that. The temperature of the global ocean is also rising. So it's becoming a warmer ocean. It's still only about 0.5 degrees Celsius warmer on average across the ocean. But, of course, with all of the carbon dioxide that we're putting up into the atmosphere, it will, you know, there is warmth, an increase in temperature locked in. Even if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide tomorrow, there would still be a certain amount of warmth. So the ocean is warming in some places very significantly. It's becoming more acidic, and indeed we do have some, right now there are more than 400 what they call dead zones, which are zones that have little or no oxygen in them in the global ocean. Now most of those are caused by chemical pollution, and the one I looked at in the Gulf of Mexico, is produced because fertilizers are running down this great Mississippi watershed into the Gulf of Mexico, and fertilizers are, you know, make plants grow on land, but also in water, and so plankton go crazy with all of this extra food and reproduce like nuts and then fall to the bottom of the seabed in the Gulf of Mexico, where bacteria decompose them and use up the oxygen as they do that. So there's this great blob. Well, the year I was there, it was 17,000 square kilometers, just an area, and that doesn't include its volume. So it just sits on the bottom of the ocean floor, and nothing can live there, or very little can live there, because most creatures in the ocean need oxygen. So fish and crabs and, you know, the things that you would expect to be living in this, in the Gulf of Mexico, are absent where there's no oxygen. The problem is that we now have three dead zones that are created just by changes in the atmosphere, which is caused by global climate change. So there are some of these three zones, which are in currents, one that is off the coast of Oregon, are caused by changes in the winds and in the temperature of the water. So when something like that happens and it's a big surprise, like these big dead zones that are caused by climate change, that makes you worry about the trend lines.
So this may seem like an insipid question, but if the zone that you talk about, the coast of Oregon and the Gulf of Mexico, they are dead now. Can they be brought to life again?
Possibly. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico disappears every fall when farmers stop putting fertilizers on their land, and then it comes back every spring. So, but it's not clear that the creatures that once lived there will go back. There have been other places in the world, like in the Black Sea, for example, where, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the subsidies for chemical fertilizers collapsed at the same time, all of a sudden all of those chemicals weren't going into the Black Sea. And everybody, all the scientists, expected the huge dead zone there to just disappear. And the dead zone did disappear, but the life didn't come back. So it's not completely clear what would happen there. The one in the Gulf of in the Oregon, at the, you know, in that part of the current, you know, may, because it's a mixing problem, it probably could you know, it could probably return to normal if the conditions that created it disappeared. But that means cutting down CO2 in the atmosphere.
Now, you interviewed someone, and I can't remember what their name was now, who studied the higher levels of CO2 in the ocean. And how long ago was that before that was sort of accepted? I mean, it wasn't accepted right away when their research came out, is that right?
That's right. The research started coming out. The first paper that I know of, that anyone knows of, was in 1998 in Science magazine. And it was derided. I mean, they literally, this was not thought to be, the pH thing was not something that people really thought could change. There, you know, it's a huge system, and there are buffer systems, you know, into buffer systems that should prevent this kind of thing from happening. And so scientists had never considered that the pH of the global ocean could change. And it was, you know, one paper written by a bunch of scientists in the States who literally, you know, were at a meeting together and put all of their information on the back of an envelope. And the one I talked to, Joni Kleipas, who's based in Colorado, looked at this and just went into the bathroom and vomited because she realized the implications of it, which are enormous.
Now, you mentioned something interesting about scientists and their research. You went from place to place, and it seemed like they didn't know what the place that you were at, what they were doing, right?
That's right. So, for example, when I went into the Gulf of Mexico, we were looking, we had all sorts of things that we were looking at in you know, sometimes three and four different ways at the same time. So we were looking at, you know, zooplankton and phytoplankton, and we were looking at salinity and temperature and depth, and, you know, just a whole bunch of different indicators of the chemistry of the and biology of that chunk of the ocean. Of course, oxygen, dissolved oxygen. But I said to them, I had just come from learning about the pH issue, and I said, so, you know, where's the pH measure? And they said, well, why would we do a pH measure? And that was characteristic. So in some, you know, some of these ideas, these concerns have not been coalesced into one, you know, one way of talking about what's happening to the ocean.
So should we be worried about that? I mean, it seems to me that these are the foremost experts on the ocean. They're not getting together. I mean, it just seems to worry me.
Yeah, they're not getting together. There was the first, or it billed itself as the very first scientific conference on this ever. It was in 2008. So, you know, there might be some hope that finally people are getting together. But we have to move quite quickly on this. This is my concern, and the reason I wrote the book is that it seems to me it's really, really important for us and the public to understand what's going on, to know what the stakes are in this. So for me, it's about democratizing this information and saying, okay, this is what this scientist is finding. If you put all the, and here's something else that somebody else is finding, and if you put all these pieces together, what you see is a trend line that is moving in absolutely the wrong direction. You know, that's, I don't know if scientists are, the scientific culture is not set up for them to become campaigners or for them to even necessarily draw implications from all the research that they're doing.
You spent some time at Dalhousie.
I did.
Looking at the effects of industrial fishing. What did the researchers there, what have they learned about the species in our oceans throughout history and I guess subsequent to industrial fishing in the sort?
There were a bunch of researchers there, but the two I talked to mostly were Heike Latze, who looks at past populations of fish in different parts of the ocean, in different parts of the global ocean, and then there's Boris Verm, who looks at what's there now compared to about 50 years ago, and then he looks at, you know, what, and they both look at what, you know, might be there in the future based on this. So what they're trying to do is establish, instead of saying, oh, last year the catch was this much, and this year it's this much, therefore this tells us what's going on in the ocean, they're saying, no, it doesn't necessarily tell us what's going on in the ocean to look at a time frame that's that narrow. Much better to look at 50 years ago when industrial fishing really started, compare those numbers to now. And Heike looks at 1,000 years ago, and she recreates all of those, she recreates populations from such things as even, I mean, there are quite a few indicators and even things such as archaeological digs. You can see what bones, you know, whose bones are there and what, you know, how many. In recipe books, you know, you can tell what the common fish are. In a whole bunch of other ways, she's able to reconstruct what used to live in different parts of the ocean. The example that I use in the book is from the Wadden Sea, which is north of Germany. And she's able to show that there are serial depletions. So we, as a species, tend to, you know, take out whatever is in the lake nearest us first, and then in the streams, and then in the nearshore ocean, and then a little bit further out in the ocean, and then even further out in the ocean. And we tend to follow the same patterns of behavior over time, over populations. So this is a human characteristic. What we do is get the fish out whatever is nearest to us, and then go a little bit further out with a little bit better technology. And then when we really get past it and we can't, you know, go any further, we start to farm fish. And they farmed carp in the Middle Ages, for example, in Europe, because they ran out of fish that they could catch easily.
And you went to China as well, and you looked at fish farming there?
I did.
What did you find out?
That was a mess. It's there are some examples in China of let's say clean aquaculture, but they are showpieces. It's not the norm. What's happening there is what's happening throughout Asia. But China is, you know, it has the biggest aquaculture production in the world by far. Outpaces any other country by far. So what's happening there is that there's destruction of mangroves to make aquaculture pens. There's just not good handling of shrimp waste and fish waste, and it's just not a good scene.
Yeah, how are we doing here? I know that that we have a certain aquaculture industry in British Columbia. Do you think we're doing things much better, perhaps?
No, I don't. We've got some, just from a biological, I'm not an expert on aquaculture in BC at all, but just from a biological perspective, not looking at the commercial aspects of it, but from a biological perspective, what we're doing is farming a species that doesn't even belong in these waters. And that's one of the critical errors. If you're going to farm something, you have to farm something that would live in those waters anyway. And that's not what we're doing. We're farming Atlantic salmon in Pacific waters. And so that's a critical error. But also we're farming a big predator fish that likes to eat other fish, that needs to eat other fish. So it's a big predator fish that's used to swimming around all over the ocean, or I mean in big, huge, you know, parts of the ocean, and eating other little fish. So, you know, we're not giving it room to roam, for one thing, so we're putting it in cages with a lot of other members of its own species, and it doesn't have room to move around. And just conceptually, that's not what those big, huge predator fish need in their living space. It's just so it's a recipe for disease and for, therefore, the use of chemicals in them. And this is not talking about any specific aquaculture farm. This is just saying conceptually, the farms that farm Atlantic salmon in the Pacific are flawed.
Yeah. In terms of what we should do as regular people, if you will,
right.
Should we eat less fish? Should we be circumspect in the sort of fish that we buy, perhaps?
I can't give you a prescription on that. I can only tell you what I do,
yeah.
Which is that I never eat shrimp anymore because they almost always come from China, and I've seen how they're grown. So that it would be a very rare thing for me to ever eat shrimp. I don't eat farmed salmon because I don't think that it's being done in a sustainable enough way. I will eat fish if it's you know, there's an ocean-wise program here in BC, and there are parts of the fishery that are handled well, that are done, you know, there's sustainable fishing. Some of the salmon stocks are still sustainably fished on the West Coast, but I'm very picky about what kinds of fish I eat. But other people may choose different things.
You write in the book, quote, "We could, if we wanted to, form a new relationship with our planet." Do you think we will?
Oh, well, I think I also write about hope in that part of the book. And to me, we are a species that we have the ability to hope, and we have the ability to plan, and we have the ability to change. Whether we'll do it in time is an open question, but I think people are pretty smart. You know, I think people are very concerned about these issues. I think that they may get stalled by despair. They may get stalled by fear of the unknown, by just thinking that maybe it's useless to even try. But I think that if enough people get together and decide that we have to change this, and we have to change it quickly, then I think we can. I mean, if you look at the whole history of of our species on the planet, this knowledge about what we're doing to the global ocean is incredibly new. I mean, it's you know, call it 10 years, maybe 20 years, but more like 10 years old, a lot of it, a lot of the more critical stuff. And we've just started to figure this out. It seems to me that if we all pull together and decide and are creative about ways that we want to conduct our lives and have our politicians, you know, help us with that we could do something really important and very, very substantial on this.
You've done a great service writing this book. Are you working on something else at the moment?
Yes, I am, but it's top secret. I'm not allowed to talk about it.
Ah, okay.
It's another science book, though.
Until then, we'll read this book. This is an important book. Congratulations on writing this, Alana, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called Seasick, The Global Ocean in Crisis, $32.99 from McClelland & Stewart. Alana Mitchell on the line. I'm Joseph Plenum.